ओम ज्ञानति मिरंधस्य ज्ञानंजन शलाकाय चक्षुर्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given us hundreds of songs and poems with various moods of bhakti. This one in particular is expressing his bhakti vinod, his pleasure in performing devotional service. So brahmachari should be happy. Srila Prabhupada's instructions, very important to follow the instructions of spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada said, chant Hare Krishna and be happy. So you must be happy. Otherwise, you're not following Srila Prabhupada's instruction. But it's chant Hare Krishna and be happy. It's not indulge in sense gratification and be happy. So it's a different kind of happiness. Singing these songs together is good activity for brahmacharis. We hear much nowadays about relationships among devotees, how relationships should be strong. But relationships, they're developed not simply by looking at each other and smiling and saying please and thank you. But relationships between devotees develop especially by accepting all kinds of difficulties or in performing devotional service, doing things together. Especially preaching Krishna consciousness, that in the modern world it's a great austerity. Srila Prabhupada said that the austerity of to Prabhavishnu Swami, he was a brahmachari at the time. He started the first traveling Sankirtan party in England. In Britain, he was traveling all over. And Srila Prabhupada wrote to him that, I know that you may not always get proper facilities for sleeping, and there may not even be proper arrangements for eating. There may be many difficulties, but Srila Prabhupada, at the end of his long letter, giving him some idea what to do, how to preach. And at the end of the letter he wrote that you should know that one day on Sankirtan is more valuable than thousands of years of austerities of the yogis. So this, it's austere, no doubt. But this austerity, when devotees perform that together, then they have a very strong bond. So it's not always that we have to be in difficult situations. We should come back also to the temples and go out from the temple. As I was saying yesterday, there's the word cloister for monks. They're shut away from the world. But brahmacharis in Krishna consciousness, they're not cloistered away from the world. They have to go out. Srila Prabhupada said the temple is not a place for eating and sleeping, but from a base from which to go out and attack Maya. And Srila Prabhupada further explained that to attack Maya means to drop hundreds and thousands of books upon the people in general, to distribute, just like in the wartime, the bombs are raining. And Srila Prabhupada had personal experience of that, of the bombs raining down.
Eating kachoris.
Yes, and eating kachoris as the bombs rain down. So going out of the temple, but we have to make our practices strong so that we have strength to act as agents of Srila Prabhupada and the Parampara in fighting Maya. So that strength will come from bhajan. Bhajan means not just singing these songs, but performing the activities of bhakti. And doing that together, reading together, chanting together, that helps to form bonds between us. Also, there is the swadhyay, that's one of the important activities for brahmachari, is the hearing. Yesterday, I was mentioning how the brahmacharis are special. All devotees, they have to hear, but especially brahmacharis, they hear. Traditionally in gurukuls, brahmacharis are trained by hearing, not by reading books. I've seen that even today. The brahmacharis are trained in learning shastra with no books. The guru will chant the mantra and the brahmacharis will repeat it. That's how they learn it. Even today it's going on in some places. So hearing, but also self-studying by oneself, reading the books, is an essential function for brahmacharis. Yesterday we finished a class it was getting quite animated. There was a discussion of how brahmacharis have been exploited. There has been, at least in the past and at present also, some culture of what can be considered exploitation of the surrendered service mood of brahmacharis. So I was going to give the class over to the two devotees who were eager to speak something about that, but neither of them are here right now. So I'll just summarize it myself. What Chandramouli Maharaj was saying was that often we see that temple leaders have what he called a fruitive mentality. They want to show we have a big project, we're doing lots of things, and they tend to see devotees as the means to fulfill their project, which is meant for pleasing Krishna. But pleasing Krishna is not simply by building big buildings and collecting lots of money, or even by distributing lots of books. It's not necessarily that what we show is pleasing to Krishna, especially if we have that motive that I want to do it to show how much I'm doing. So in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, the society is made up not so much of buildings and assets, but of the members of the society. So we always have to remember that people have to come first. We have to see to the needs of the devotees. But on the other hand, I also wanted to bring in this point that we do have things to do in Krishna's service also. And Srila Prabhupada did want us to do big things in Krishna's service. And so it's not a one-way discussion. It's not that, it's just that, well, we just have to look after the devotees and having temples and all these things, they don't matter. They do matter. And that's service for the brahmacharis to perform, various services for running on the temples or preaching projects. So there's the overall preaching of the institution, which includes establishing and maintaining temples. And there are the needs of the individual, and sometimes they may appear to be contrary to each other. So, and also it may be that from the viewpoint of the temple leaders, that they have to, every day the offerings to deities have to go on. So someone has to do it. And sometimes we've seen GBC or temple president sannyasis. I've seen they're in the pujari room making the offerings, cleaning up late at night because someone has to do it. So those who are joining in the kind of emergency circumstances, and mostly our temples seem to be in emergency circumstances, we're always overextended. Even if there's no need to be, we're always overextended. And that's actually the way that Bhaktisiddhanta and Saraswati and our own Srila Prabhupada always kept everything overextended. So that everyone is busy all the time. Srila Prabhupada described that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati would send his disciples out to collect for a project, and then they'd collect, and then he'd spend it on something else. And then he said, well, I need money for this project. And he said, well, we already gave it to you. Well, I use it for something else. So now you have to go out again and do it. So it's a pushing movement. The needs of the individuals should be seen to, and it's brahmacharya, as I was saying yesterday, someone who's dedicated their life for the sake of serving Krishna, for making spiritual advancement, they deserve to be in an atmosphere where the leaders themselves set an example of that and are actually interested in the devotees who have come into their care making spiritual advancement. They should be interested. If they're not interested in the spirit, if they don't manifest any interest in the devotee's spiritual advancement, they see them simply as a free pot washer for 1 or 2 months until he goes away, and then someone else will come, and if not, we'll hire someone. Then, obviously, it's not likely you're going to make much spiritual advancement in such an atmosphere. But then again, it's not that because you're asked to wash the pot, you say, no, I have to chant my rounds. Devotees who are in the temple should also understand that there are services that need to be performed, and it's not always exactly according to what we might think should be the ideal life of a monk. There's always do the needful is always there. It may be that there are services to perform which we weren't expecting. Dhanavir Maharaj told me many years ago, this is how I remember it. If you ask him, he might tell it to you a little bit differently. That when, let's open this door. That door has just been closed for some reason. We need some air. I was suffocating in the morning class because the door also got closed. He told me that when he first came to the temple, he had some questions. So they told him, go see Jayananda. It must have been that he joined in San Francisco, I suppose. All right, let's get the door open and then everyone can try and listen again because everyone's attention is diverted to the door opening. I notice that many times when a lecture is going on, someone will walk in the room. It's not a major event or even an event of any interest whatsoever, but everyone's attention is diverted to that. Our attention is diverted so easily. So anyway, he was told to go see Jayananda because no one knew any answers to any questions. So he asked, where is Jayananda? And he said, well, at this time he's probably out the back taking out the garbage. So he was to Dhanavir at that time, was not Dhanavir Maharaj. He was directed to go out the back, and then he was told, this is Jayananda. So yeah, and the first thing Dhanavir Maharaj asked him, how is it that you're so happy? All his other questions he forgot about. How is it that you're so happy? And Jayananda's Prabhu, his answer was that, well, I don't know. I don't have that much time to think about it. But hey, look, help me take out the garbage. And that was the answer to the question, actually. Because he's completely absorbed in service and he doesn't have time to think about so many different things. How can I be happy? If I was doing this, I'd be happy. If I was doing something else, I would be happy. But he's just fully absorbed in serving Krishna. That's why he's so happy. And he gave a practical demonstration of that to the first immediate engagement in devotional service as soon as he came to the temple. Maharaj, I was going to begin this session with having a guest speaker, namely yourself. You were wanting to say something yesterday. I kind of summarized the point. You were saying, talking about fruitive mentality. We have to look after the devotees. Do you want to say something about that now? You wanted to say that yesterday, but we ran out of time. Where are we? We're in San Francisco, circa 1971. Jayananda. Working hard and being happy. You kind of lost the thread. All right, so... Okay, all right, it's a big subject. All right. I talked a little bit about how leaders have to look after the devotees in their care, and the devotees also have to understand that there are services to be performed, and like that. It's a two-way, it's not a one-way street. That if you're asked to wash the potatoes, you say, forget it, I'm going to another temple.
We got bigger, better potatoes there. Actually, in my presentation yesterday, we got into it.
I see, yeah.
The point was that, and I was making it clear, that we expect full surrender, because if someone comes in, especially in terms of brahmachari, we expect them to follow the temple program, we expect them to do their service, to go up to the standard. Then again, on the other side, there's not enough, what we say, facilities and programs to take care of the needs of the devotees. Mm. Therefore, there seems somewhat of a question of, well, if I have to fully surrender, can I actually get everything I need in order to practice Krishna consciousness within this environment?
Mm.
In terms of both material needs and spiritual care and protection.
Mm. I would suggest that with the situation of the brahmachari ashram in North America today, that who wants to join as a brahmachari should look very carefully and find some good association, and the local temple may say, no, you must join here. But first thing, one has to become strong oneself, and that will be facilitated by joining in a place where there is some brahmachari consciousness. And then as that can develop, then more and more brahmacharis can join, and then they can maybe send some others off to other places. But if there's no consciousness of that, if there's no encouragement or support or atmosphere for that, then it would seem obvious to have a look around a bit and see where your brahmachari life can be best facilitated.
I'm on one of the social system, not just a spiritual practice, which is the foundation for successful spiritual practice. So both that would be. We get people who come and they stay a year, 2 years, and after a while, maybe even three. I think the average is five. And then there's what we call revolving door policy. People come and people go. Discouraged, and they finally can't fulfill both their spiritual and material concerns within the ashram. So either they want to get married, or they have health problems, or they're not getting the proper education, or not getting the proper diagnosis of how best they can serve. All these things could create a kind of, what we say, hesitation to give oneself completely.
Hmm.
So, I'm not saying it's all, on the side of the temple, but when you have a good social structure, and you have a high standard, then you can even actually produce quality. Devotees.
Yeah.
And really, we're looking for quality. Because quality actually is a foundation for creating more quality. Once you establish a nice, strong core of devotees who are the foundation of the ashram, this attracts other people, and you have a standard which is a good standard, and others have to come up to that standard.
Mm.
If you don't have any standard, then the lowest standard becomes the standard.
Right, yeah. And then even anyone who joins, where the standard is what the individual wants to make it, it's going to be a low standard. And then even those who come idealistically reading Prabhupada's books, and they want to experience the life that they read about in those books, or they envisage in those books, when they join the temple, they find it something different. And even if they want to live it idealistically, in many cases, they not only they not have support for it, but they may be even ridiculed or discouraged from doing that by others who are more or less just using the temple as a facility for their eating, sleeping, and who knows what else.
Serious devotees might even say, why try? I'm not getting support more. I might as well go somewhere else.
Yeah. That's an important point, though you're talking about the revolving door policy. That's maybe another reason why temples, they're not very enthusiastic to train up brahmacharis. One, because they're saying, what's the use? We train them, we put in time and energy to training them up, and then after some time they just go away anyway. They go outside and get married, so what's the point? That has to be addressed also. Because it's a fact that even if we do have a high standard, we're still in America especially, we're still going to lose to the brahmachari ashram probably at least 50% within 5 years or 10 years. I mean, the initial turnover is quite high of those that get that far of wanting to join and being allowed to join. Some who want to join may not even be fit to join. But then some may last just a few days or a few weeks. But those who stay for, say, more than 6 months, out of them, within a few years, we usually see that they're thinking, well, I'm not going to be able to do this all my life. They may remain devotees, and the time that they've spent in the brahmachari ashram will be very helpful as the basis for their ongoing life in Krishna consciousness. But they get married, or they go outside, and then what's next? That should also be considered. Srila Prabhupada, of course, as we're hearing a lot nowadays, and I'm glad we're hearing it a lot, because talking about it is a beginning to actually doing it, is Srila Prabhupada's wanting to establish rural communities so that grihastas don't have to go to the secular workplace and get entangled with materialistic people and a way of life which is not conducive to Krishna consciousness. So we're talking here about the brahmachari ashram, but we have to remember that the brahmachari ashram is one of four ashrams, and the ashrams, they don't operate independently of each other. They're interactive. The brahmachari ashram, traditionally the brahmachari ashram cannot function without the other ashrams, and that's true of all the other ashrams. They're all interdependent. So it's important also that the Grihastha devotees, who are coming to the temple, they also be cared for all devotees and encouraged to come up, and that they can understand the needs of the brahmacharis, not that the brahmacharis are preached to, what are you doing? You're wasting your time. You should just go get a job. But at least the grihasthas should encourage and appreciate what they're doing. And the brahmacharis can also, while reading and studying such verses as Yan maituna adi grihamedi sukham hituchham. Who knows the meaning of this verse? The gist of the verse of which this is the first line? Anyone else? Who else knows? Only two. Three. Anyone else? Slowly the hands are coming up. Are you afraid to admit it or what? All right, the purport is, it's Prahlad Maharaj speaking, a five-year-old boy, Prahlad Maharaj, who actually later entered Grihastha Ashram, saying that the happiness of family life, it's the prime happiness in family life is sex, and it is insignificant. So there are many verses like this in Bhagavatam, and brahmachari should know them, and grihasthas should know them also. But while memorizing verses like that, that's very good for brahmachari life, to memorize verses. At the same time, to respect the grihastha devotees. Because in many ways, the grihastha devotees' commitment to Krishna, in one way, their commitment is more than that of the brahmacharis, because the brahmacharis, they have, their lifestyle is such that they have nothing but Krishna consciousness 24 hours a day. But with the grihasthas, they have all the difficulties of maintaining a family which takes up so much time and practically all their energy. And there are so many diversions, and still if they're practicing Krishna consciousness very seriously, that's great commitment. So that should be appreciated also. The mutual appreciation is required. So that's something for senior devotees to cultivate among the brahmacharis and among the grihasthas, and then there are We don't have vanaprastas, traditional vanaprastas so much. We have divorcees. Sorry, but it's true. And but traditional vanaprastas, where they have they marry young, they have children, and then the children, when they get older, then the man and his wife, either they leave their home in the care of the eldest son and travel to holy places, or the man leaves the wife at home and goes to holy places, or spends some time in the temple, then again comes back home, and like this. We don't have that so much. But we have sannyasis. And sannyasis are also very much needed as the, of course, the Brahmins in general are the spiritual leaders of society, but especially the sannyasis. So brahmacharis are traditionally, well, there are different kinds of brahmacharis. One is the brahmachari gurukul evasan. He's living in the young boy living in the gurukul with his, in the forest, generally with his grihastha guru who's teaching him. But another kind of brahmachari is the brahmachari in the mutt, who is serving a servant of a sannyasi, or traveling traveling preaching sannyasi. So, on the topic of yesterday we were talking about authority, and this comes to an important question which I want to discuss. How a brahmachari especially is always under some authority, and especially everyone in Vedic culture is under some authority. If the king is under an authority, the Brahmin is under the authority of his guru, everyone's under an authority. But as one becomes more responsible, he'll be given more freedom to exercise his own judgment in how to serve Krishna best. So just like we have Vijay Prabhu, for instance, is a more or less independent brahmachari, but independent in the sense that he's traveling and serving the mission and contributing to the mission, and he doesn't go against the... His independence, it's not a declaration of independence, but it's something that's naturally accrued to him because of his dedication to serving the mission. But that's not for a new brahmachari. Especially a new brahmachari should be guided at every step. So I discussed that somewhat yesterday. Now, in the matter of authority, we always read in Srila Prabhupada's books and throughout Shastra how devotees in general, and particularly brahmacharis, they're under the authority of their guru. But practically in day-to-day life in ISKCON, we find that devotees don't see their gurus very much, and the gurus don't see their disciples very much. And the immediate authority is the temple president. So how does that work? Now, as I was saying, generally the brahmachari is the servant of a sannyasi or the servant of his grihastha guru. That gurus travel widely and initiate widely is sometimes criticized, but it's not something new. That has been going on for many years. Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Madhavendra Puri, Shankaracharya, they all traveled widely and preached and initiated people widely. We find it's described in Chaitanya Bhagavat how Madhavendra Puri came to the home of Advaita Acharya, who must have received his Vedic initiation. I mean, he was a Brahmin by caste, at least from the external perspective, but he took Vaishnava initiation from Madhavendra Puri when Madhavendra Puri came to his home. And then after that, it seems that quite likely they never met each other again. Madhavendra Puri was wandering here and there. So it's not unknown, even in the previous times when there wasn't intercontinental communication and you couldn't listen to a class live on the other side of the world. What I'm saying is that nowadays that's even more facilitated than it was previously. But it's a question which has been discussed in the GBC for the last few years, that of parallel authority, that devotees in the temple are supposed to work under the temple authorities, but then the devotees themselves tend to lean towards or trust their gurus more. That tendency is there. And they play one authority off another. Well, if they're politicians, that's not very good. So who should you follow? Well, the argument is, well, the temple authorities are there. They actually know the devotee very well, and therefore they should follow the temple authority. Well, ideally, the two authorities lines should be in accord with each other and have a good understanding. But it may be that the temple president is seen as someone who has just wants me to get something done, whereas my guru, his only interest in me is my spiritual advancement. It's sometimes seen like that. Or it's sometimes seen the temple president may change, or I may change. I may not be in this temple forever, but the relationship with the guru is ongoing. So what's the solution to this? I don't know if there is a solution. It's unique. There's never been such a situation in the history of Vaishnavism, as far as I know.
Can I offer a suggestion?
Can I just say a few more words? And then, this is a discussion topic. I don't have any solutions. It's something that can be discussed. As far as possible, if the temple leaders and the gurus of the devotees are in accord with each other, then that's the best solution. But as we're finding in our society, there are very different approaches and very different opinions on a wide variety of issues. So it can be confusing for the devotees who are supposed to follow. Therefore, we should try to understand what is Siddhanta. We say there are different opinions on different issues, but what is the actual conclusion of Shastra and of the Acharyas? That we should act according to that. All right, Maharaj, please say. Okay. It's not just that everything's a matter of opinion. Of course, there may be different approaches in Krishna consciousness, and the different approaches may be different, but it's not that because they're different that one is right and another is wrong. For instance, in book distribution, we may say that it's better to speak to people about the value of the book and tell them this is something which will help you to lead a better life and this and that. But I was just speaking with Sureshra Prabhu, he distributes on Waikiki Beach in Honolulu, and he told me that that kind of line among the tourists, they're just in an enjoying mood. It doesn't work. You'll sell very few books if you do like that. So he is involved in the Food for Life program, and he stops the tourists, shows them I'm doing this, takes a donation and gives them a book. So, well, he said you didn't. All right. All right, okay. But I'm just saying that, and in England we've always found that distributing big books has always been quite difficult there. I mean, even in the heyday of Tripurari Maharaj, he came there, and I'm going to show them how to do it, but he was also stumped there. So it may be that different approaches in different places, and the most idealistic approach may work somewhere and not elsewhere. We may say it's better to go in devotee clothes to distribute books. Maybe in some places it's not. Maybe still it's in some places it's better to wear kami clothes. So in many cases it's not like one approach is correct and the other one is damn you, go to hell, burn in hell forever because you put on kami clothes when you're distributing books. So that Chandramouli Maharaj was saying yesterday that we've got such important things to, we've got such important issues we were discussing after yesterday. We've got such important issues to revive our movement, and then but devotees are spending so much energy on discussing whether women should be called Mataji or Prabhu. But this issue, well, this issue, it can cause a lot of blood boiling, and like my approach to this is, well, I don't like to call women Prabhu, and I see the Prabhupada didn't, but at the same time, I'm not going to put out lots of energy to if women want to be called Prabhu, I won't call them Prabhu, I'll call them Devi, something like that. You can say so-and-so Devi, and then that's like another term, which is a neutral term. I don't know why they don't like to be called Mother, but again, this is an issue which generates a lot of blood boiling, but it's better not to get involved in. We should understand among ourselves that the traditional culture is to call Mataji, but there are some ladies in our movement at the present time who they're not going to accept that. And apparently Prabhupada at some point also did call some women Prabhu, so if they want, then what can you do? But yeah, I'm not going to fight with them.
The point I was making was that there's things that are really critical.
There are things which are really critical, and we expend so much energy on less critical points, yeah. But if I get round to it, I was going to speak about, I was going to talk about feminism, homosexuality, and other issues which are prominent in society today. So, what's the discussion then about parallel lines of authority? That's something which needs to be. Well, what do you all feel? You are the ones who are in this situation. Mahatattva Prabhu wants to say something. Oh, there's just one thing. Before we open it up, sorry. The situation our movement nowadays is such. I mean, I'm saying nowadays, but those who are coming don't know anything else. But there was a time when, in our movement, it was Prabhupada said, and that was it, and then everyone just accepted it, and it was very clear and straightforward and simple. But nowadays the situation is you'll get so many people telling you so many different things that devotees tend to assess everything themselves and come to their own conclusion. And then we find that in our movement, what it seems to me, the most powerful opinion former is not Prabhupada's books or what's said in Bhagavatam classes, but what comes out on the internet. On the various fora, it seems very influential that opinions are formed from the internet. But we should form that from guru, sadhu, and shastra. That's the actual way. And anyone who has the time and the nerve to go out and say something. And they become a self-made authority just because they come out and write their name. And we find that some persons have become very influential in our society, not that they have any record of any outstanding service, if any service, but just because they're always out there on the internet putting out their opinion. So beware of internet pundits. Always try to understand what is in Prabhupada's books, Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. This is the standard. Yes, please.
We had a case here. There was one Mataji. We met her out there. We brought her to Krishna consciousness. We nourished her in Krishna consciousness. She actually lived at the temple. And then I noticed that, you know, through our conversation, she would bring up that her guru told her this, this, and that. So that, you know, I found out who the guru was. I sent him an email. And it was, he actually apologized. And then we started to, you know, work with this soul together.
Mm-hmm. That's an example of cooperation between temple president and guru. Another common case is that of devotees whose guru has fallen away from the strict standard of devotional service. And an increasingly common case is that of devotees who have accepted a guru, but then their own guru, he changes his whole outlook on Krishna consciousness. And so the devotee is left with what he has imbibed and then what his guru is saying and doing now. And there are cases of devotees who have difficulty placing their faith in their gurus, and because of their present, they haven't fallen from Krishna consciousness, but they're acting and speaking in ways that the devotees no longer feel they can place their full faith in them. And these are, I mean, I said in my manifesto, I said I wanted to discuss issues relevant to brahmacharis today. These are issues relevant to brahmacharis today, are they not? Not just brahmacharis, but for all devotees. They're sensitive issues, but they're real issues, so they should be discussed. What would you have done in the case where the guru said that no, these are the principle and you are wrong, temple president, and then what do you do? And then this is the reason why the temple presidents are saying that they should have the authority, because they do the hard work to make the devotees, but then so they become the disciple of a guru and then they just go away somewhere else. These are issues. These are real issues in our society. Yes, please.
So I want to say that I don't see in North America Gurukul Brahmachari.
We don't see Gurukul Brahmachari.
There is no speaking in this seminar about opening a Gurukul, maybe a school for Brahmachari, we should.
Because
send their kids in this school, so in this way.
We require real Gurukuls, yes, Srila Prabhupada wanted that. But what we're discussing here in this seminar is how to get the Brahmachari ashram in the temples. That's mainly our focus, because unless and until we get that together, then having gurukuls with brahmacharis, that seems like a more distant prospect. But yes, it is required. We Srila Prabhupada, his idea of education was very different to that which is going on in ISKCON today, which is more or less secular education with, if you're lucky, a few Hare Krishnas thrown in. So yes, gurukuls are very much necessary, but the devotees expected to attend this seminar are brahmacharis, temple brahmacharis, so we're addressing the needs and issues facing temple brahmacharis. But that's certainly true, that real gurukuls are required. Yes, please give the mic to Advaita Acharya Ishwaram, as he's called.
The discussion of having many, or the opportunity for many shikshas, or
shiksha gurus, you mean? Yeah, that's an American tendency to many shikshas. The word is shiksha guru.
It seems like it's no one to be blamed, especially in the case of a new devotee or young devotee, because
but it may be confusing. That's the point.
But we are the ones who are giving the importance of approaching. So, and there is a potential danger of having more than two or three points of references. and, you know, getting into a space of confusion. So it seems like there's no one to be blamed because there are all these.
It's, you mean it's a reality of life in ISKCON today, and we just have to get on and live with it?
Well, the thing is, they're all serving Krishna, hopefully, according to Siddhanta.
Well, that's the point. Is it hopefully? Is it only hopefully? Siddhanta balaya chitte nakara alash. We should understand what is Siddhanta. It's not just hopeful.
Well, that's that they are actually serving Krishna according to Siddhanta in a very.
Well, that question may arise. That is it according to Siddhanta? Often it's mooted that there are various preaching techniques that are required which are not directly Krishna conscious, and these are good for bringing people to Krishna consciousness. I personally am very cautious about this, because if you don't aim at the bullseye, you know what that is, in the center of a what's that called? A target? What's that called? Target, yeah. If you don't aim at that, you might miss the board altogether. So, there are various preaching techniques mooted where we introduce something else instead of Krishna consciousness and then gradually introduce Krishna consciousness, but then do we actually bring people to Krishna consciousness? Just like, for instance, there are many examples. One is Krishna-conscious rock music, if there's such a thing. And the idea is that, well, people like rock music and they don't like Krishna-conscious. So let's play rock music, which is Krishna-conscious, and then gradually that will bring people to Krishna-consciousness. So it seems like a good idea, and it might be possible for some to do, but then it may be that the devotees who are doing that, they're doing that more because of their own tendency toward rock music. And they may get more involved in that rather than in Krishna consciousness. Or the people who come may come because they like the rock music, but then when you bring the Krishna consciousness, they're not that much interested. So are these other... So there may be... You see, someone may want to engage a devotee in some program which the guru who's taken responsibility for their spiritual life is very afraid that by engaging them in this program, they're going to lose their Krishna consciousness altogether. So it may be nice to say that we're all working together and it's all good and everything's wonderful. But I'm just trying to give some example of where there may be serious disagreements. And then the guru may say, no, don't do this with all late nights and hellish music and bad association and not presenting Krishna consciousness directly. And then we say, no, well, we made him a devotee. So these are the kind of things that may arise and do arise. Can we hear from Mukunda Datta Prabhu, who has got many wise things to say? On this general discussion, on the mixed authority and the confusion that can arise from this.
There has always been some degree of conflict between temporal and spiritual authorities, even in Vedic culture, but certainly within India's history. It's a long-recognized problem.
Could you give some example of that, please?
I can't give a specific historical example offhand. I don't know that they do exist, but I think the principle that we're talking about is that, you know, traditionally the Kshatriyas derived their authority to rule by dint of the fact that they were approved, they were endorsed, so to speak, by the Brahmins.
Mm.
On the other hand, the Brahmins really couldn't do a whole lot unless they had, you see, time after time after time, that they can't really do the preaching that they want to do unless they have state support.
Hmm.
So it is a symbiotic relationship, as you said before. All the Vrindavans and all the ashrams, you know, they have have that tendency. But it has also led to the kinds of problems that we are experiencing this one. And I think that for that reason, we can learn from history. In the 11th canto, there's a very nice verse that Krishna tells Uddhava, in which he says there are not three pramanas, but four. And the fourth one is aidihya, itihasa history, tradition, traditional convention or tradition in general. So we can, if we are having trouble reconciling this basically perennial tendency, then we can learn from the past. That's my thing.
All right, Parameshwar Prabhu wants to say something. He had something to say about this yesterday also. He's had some personal difficulties in his life due to such issues.
Dealing with this quite often. And could have been extremely disastrous at one point in my life. But I think I thought a lot of times that I feel like there's probably others that are dealing with such issues. And seems like the way to resolve it, since the lack of trust gets broken down, is every brahmachari should know, or even every person that joins the temple should know what their rights are.
That's an American solution.
And then, okay, I can work within these parameters. I know my parameters. And if I feel like they're being violated, okay, no problem. I can present, okay, I have these, I know my parameters.
Maybe that is this in a world in which authorities, realistically speaking, we are experiencing difficulties with authorities. Maybe that is the not exactly the solution, but that should be a consideration, that a devotee should know what you may call their rights. That every devotee is entitled to. Or should expect that if he's willing to sacrifice and give his life, that there should be a reciprocation and respect for that. And who to follow if there's a differing authorities, we should follow those who we perceive have our actual self-interest at heart. That's a general thing. But then again, it may be difficult for those who are very new to understand these things. If you join in a place where the Brahmachari ashram is quite strong, then you probably won't experience these difficulties so much anyway. Mahatattva Prabhu?
Let's make one last counselor program. I always thought of that also. If I just had somebody I could...
The counselor program, It's a good idea, but the counselors themselves, I've seen problems with this also, when the counselors themselves, they're not really fit to counsel others, and I've seen some pretty bad exploitation. So it's a good idea, but the real thing is, as Prabhupada said, that first of all, we have to establish a class of brahmanas. Then everything else gets in order. How some devotees resolve it is by going away from Krishna consciousness or practicing it at a distance in a very weak way or joining another Vaishnava institution, which is not a very... We don't feel very happy about that. It's better they join another Vaishnava institution than go away from Krishna consciousness altogether. But really, we should be very much working on making the house that Srila Prabhupada established, the house in which the whole world can actually live. Yeah.
Well, we know that one of the duties of a disciple, to put it in such terms, is to know Shastra and to the disciple should be able to recognize when the authority is out of line. That's, otherwise, how can you be a disciple? You also have to have some knowledge of Shastra.
Right, that's true.
If your authority is, you know, wipe out, you should be able to tell that.
Well, what we often see is that someone comes to Krishna consciousness, and especially in the beginning, they naturally tend to be submissive and wanting to follow, and then we find someone maybe in a leadership position who's strong-minded but not strong in Krishna consciousness, and they insist, "Oh, you have to do what I say because I'm the leader. Who are you to say anything? I'm a devotee for 25 years. Who are you to say anything? And I know what I'm doing." But then you see that practically they're, in some cases, they themselves, their own spirit, they may be a devotee for 25 years, but their day-to-day spiritual life is nowhere. You don't see them in the temple hardly at all. So in such cases, I would say don't serve under someone who's not in Mangalarti, who's not attending temple programs. You don't have to. Or maybe that they're attending temple programs. There may be someone who's following all these things, but at the same time, they deal with others in a very dictatorial manner. Anyway, if you don't have the problem, I guess you don't have to worry about it. But then, on your personal level, but as a society, we have to work towards making a truly Krishna conscious culture. Yes, please. Dhir Prashanta Prabhu. And another thing also, that please don't expect that every leader should be absolutely perfect devotee in all respects, otherwise you can't follow them. Position is also to be respected. There's always a dynamic between these following the authority. Srila Prabhupada definitely wanted all the devotees to follow authority. But on the other hand, we should not commit our lives to authorities who, by following them, we won't have spiritual benefit.
So, I'd like to say something regarding the problem which may arise between the temple authority and the devotees, especially Brahmins who are dedicating their lives. So, one thing which attracting the devotees consciousness is this loving attachment relationship, so which comes from authority, and it can be checked very easily within a short period of time, a few months or a year, by seeing how responding any authority when some needs there from side of the devotee of the Brahmacharya. Especially, we are talking about the devotees who are really dedicated, they're sincere, and they want to do service according to their capacity. And if real loving relationship is there, even though it is perfect, some mistakes may be there from the side of the devotees. To put on the practical side, practical field, like one example, thank you so much. Very close to me, one devotee, after doing my service for one temple, another temple doesn't matter, approached to authorities and said, "I have a problem, I have a root canal problem, I have to cure it and repair or fix." So, now any authority took seriously the problem. The problem may be real danger for the person because it can spread out.
It's very painful also.
Painful, really. I'm seeing the devotee, I don't want to say his name yet, if you want to say it. And I've seen him for days in painful condition. I'm eating this corpse because they're like in pain and doing his service day by day. And authorities were talking about big projects in the temple itself, talking about a few $100,000 spending in bricks. Okay, maybe we can say it's the expansion of Balaram, but you have temple,
yeah, it's the point we're making, that you're talking about big projects and doing big things, but not looking after the devotees.
And the problem is that they always same thing. We don't have money. This and that. But you know, they're spending for so many different tiles in the bathroom, or I don't know, this and that, and hundreds of dollars are going around, and thousands of dollars. But when this question about basic care about the devotees, it happens sometimes.
It does happen, yeah. It's not the first time we've heard this.
And then the devotees are losing faith.
Right, okay. All right, well, don't mind, I'm going to cut you out there, although it is an unfortunate thing which we see from time to time. One topic which I didn't touch at all, and it was supposed to be 1D, but I only have 10 minutes left. I'll do a quick summary of that in 10 minutes. Brahmacharya in an age of sexual promiscuity, feminism, and homosexuality. We live in an age in which attitudes towards sex are very different to those of 100 years ago. Or the attitudes towards sex are very different. Sexual relations, they're very different to what's been the norm in most societies throughout the world since time immemorial. So that devotees who are joining our temples, who are brahmacharis, they're joining with attitudes which are, or they've been raised with an understanding of the role of the sexes and sexual interactions which are very different from traditional attitudes. For instance, it's considered normal in Western society and increasingly all over the world for men and women to mix freely both before and after marriage. It's considered heretical, practically, to suggest that men should have a dominant role in society over women, which has been the tradition and the norms, again, since time immemorial. And it's even considered heretical and maybe illegal in some places to suggest that there's anything wrong with homosexuality. Or, and even in the schools, in some places, they may be teaching that, just like I saw in India in the school, in the school book, they're teaching all the kinds of food we eat: vegetable, fruit, grain, sugar, eggs, fish, meat, and it's just taught like that. So they may be teaching, and in the sex education, which why they have need to have that in schools anyway is another question, but they're teaching that, well, sex is something you do for pleasure, and any hole will do. Any hole that attracts you, use it. Or you can become the hole for someone else. So it's a very gross way of saying it, but it's a very gross subject, and that's how people are raised in the modern age. However, Srila Prabhupada, as a representative of Shastra, of Vyasadeva, and of sanity, presented a very different outlook. So nowadays in our ISKCON society, I'm saying nowadays because things have changed. Previously, there was attempt at separation between the sexes. Actually, in the very earliest days of the movement, when the devotees were joining, first of all, Srila Prabhupada didn't introduce many rules of varnashram or many rules at all of any kind. And so we find in the very earliest days the men and the women would be dancing together in kirtan, but then after some time they separated. What happened? Well, this is actually documented in one paper, which was very influential and became the basis of the formation of a woman's ministry in ISKCON. And it was stated in there that in the beginning days, Srila Prabhupada allowed the men and women to mix, but then some of the sannyasis, they separated the men and the women so that they stood in different parts of the temple room. And when they're circumambulating Tulsi, They used to all circumambulate together, but then they started doing it separately. And it was proposed that all this was done because the sannyasis had some kind of vendetta against women. But as I understand it, Srila Prabhupada started preaching about these things and writing about these things. And some of Srila Prabhupada's disciples going to India and seeing the culture there, which Prabhupada wanted devotees to learn of, they saw that actually men and women should be separated. And it's not just something in Vedic culture, even in the churches. I don't know about today, but when I was a kid and went to church, the men were on one side and the women on the other. So separation of the sexes is a required principle in any civilization. There should be separation, otherwise, as is stated in Bhagavatam and in Manu, the principle of if men and women come together, that even if one may sit next to one's mother, daughter, or sister, Balavan Indriya Gramo, the senses are so strong that Vidvangsham Apikarshati, even someone who knows, who's a learned scholar, he may be disturbed even by sitting next to his mother, sister, or daughter. So the tendency, especially for brahmachari, should be to avoid association with women. That doesn't mean being nasty to women, but not interacting with them any more than required. Now, if we do that, the women may complain, well, they're ignoring us, which they're not nice to us. But actually, for brahmacharis, their dealings with women should be only as much as necessary, not anything more than that. So, what to do? Actually, the brahmachari ashram is the one in which there's least interaction with women. I found after taking sannyas, my interaction with women increased. And Chandramouli Maharaj is nodding his head there, because a sannyasi is a social figure. And families look to sannyasis as like the spiritual head of the family. And if you have disciples, then many of them are going to be women. So sannyasis usually have disciples. But I myself find that it's a funny thing that it's women, at least when you see them, they may want some recognition, so you may look at them to say Hare Krishna, but sometimes they don't need, some are so chaste or whatever that they don't even want to be seen like that, which traditionally you wouldn't look at a woman and say, hello, Hare, how are you, or any such thing. But then if you don't do that, they may think, well, he's just ignoring me. So you don't know. If you do like that, some may not like it. Why is he looking at me? And if you don't do it, then someone may say, why is he not looking at me? Why is he ignoring me? So what should you do? Also, I saw once a photo of it. It was a seminar on Vaishnava etiquette somewhere here in North America. And there were tables with five or six devotees at each table. All the women and men were all mixed up. I thought, what is this, Vaishnava etiquette? They should be at separate tables. So that's there. It's the modern way of thinking that we should all mix up and we're all... But it's actually brahmacharis, they should remain separate. And again, not be rude. And if there's service to do, and many times there may be service which requires that you have some interaction. But polite, formal, and as little as possible. It's really best for brahmacharis. Who was telling me that just the other day? That there was one devotee who was temple president, he was a brahmachari, and he was a brahmachari for 3 years as the temple president. And everyone was telling him that you can't last. But he had a system where the matajis, he would speak to, they wouldn't come in his office. If they wanted to speak to him, he would speak to them on the phone from outside. And they were saying, oh, this is fanatical. But he did that. And he was, then everyone was telling him it's fanatical, so he started letting them in his office, and he would talk to them. Within 2 months, he was married. So... Huh? So we should... And then there's... Yeah, and then the question of homosexuality, well, it's not so much a question, because if any... Better that... people with homosexual tendencies don't live in the ashram, that's all. It's too much of a risk, because if they're attracted to male, if a male is attracted to a male form, then how can he live in the brahmachari ashram? It's bad for him and bad, it's dangerous for the brahmacharis also. So, I'm sorry there's no more time to discuss these. There are also issues in this complex age in which we live. So, anyway, maybe some other time we can discuss them more. And also about homosexuality, we should understand, contrary to modern propaganda, it's not normal or natural. It may be that some people, they do have that tendency from birth, but we should understand that it's, according to Shastra, it is due to previous sinful life. It's not something that we should... All right, we're all sinful, but at the same time, we shouldn't think that it's normal, it's natural, and it's okay. And that homosexual marriage is okay. Yes, please, Maharaj. Sorry, I don't have time to discuss this more, but there is no more time.
A little Prabhupada humor on this point.
Yes.
So it was your, I think it was your conclusion was, there was one person in the ashram who was male, but very much with feminine characteristics and activities. So the devotees wrote Prabhupada said, well, have him stick to one ashram. Designate
him
some way or
another,
but then stick to
that. Well, there was that someone wanting a sex change operation
no,
or something?
No.
Ashram.
Well, they didn't know where to engage him.
Either as
he was better with the women, but at the same time he was a man. So Prabhupada said, well,
I can't understand. They were thinking of sticking him in the Brahmacharini ashram?
Prabhupada wrote back.
No, that's not that one.
You just stick to one ashram. It's kind of like a funny little...
I didn't get it. I'm sorry. I lost it. What did you understand by that? That he should either remain in the Brahmacharya ashram or go outside?
He didn't know how to engage him. He did better associating with women because he was more like a woman, but at the same time he was in a male body.
Yeah, so it is an increasing phenomenon. And we do find people who are trying to be Krishna conscious, and they're homosexuals, and anyway, we don't have time to discuss it now. But better they don't live in the ashram is my conclusion.
It's actually not healthy for, because it's not so good for them and for the audience.
Yeah.
And nowadays you don't know.
You don't know, yeah.
Something was too late.
Well, maybe that's something that they should be, when they're coming in, they should be screened for their sexuality. Seriously, I mean, it's such a crazy world we live in. They should be asked, are you homo, hetero, or bi? Or the best is ah.